on lessons in resilience.
Good afternoon. I'm Sig Snap, agronomist from Michigan State University, and appreciate very much this opportunity. It's great to be here. I remember when we first had little small notes up about organic and sustainable ag working group at the agronomy societies, and it was posted in the just in the bathrooms, and so it was very subtle, but anyway, it took years and years of organizing to see this come about, so we're very excited. But here today I'm reporting about an effort that you should know about, because it is your taxpayer dollar that is supporting this. This is kind of where LTARs, the long-term agricultural research in the U.S. and the world, intersects with the long-term ecological research. So I just want to mention these long-term ecological research sites, part of the sometimes just referred to by the LTER network, is how society is investing in long-term monitoring to understand slow processes like we heard about, like soil carbon, and how to manage these ecosystems. They include a number of forested systems like the Harvard Forest. They include some urban sites, Baltimore and Phoenix. They include some ocean currents, so some really different ecosystems. And guess how many agricultural ones? Just one. And although I hope you'll be interested in the work we're presenting, we don't nearly represent all the diversity in agriculture ecosystems, so I hope that there will be more in the future. And that we can support, in September 2014, we are talking about trying to have a big meeting where we celebrate the 25th anniversary, and a book we're finally coming out with some lessons that we've learned at the LTR, and also kickstart some how can we keep supporting LTARs, including ourselves and others. So we look forward to some announcements. I'll try and get that out so that you know to put that on your calendars, if at all possible, Michigan in September. A little nicer than right now. So as I said, we are in Michigan. And we have a central question that was posed by Phil Robertson, our leader, and colleagues. And it's held up pretty well for 25 years of this question. To what extent can we manage field crops with biology rather than chemistry while still maintaining services such as notably yield, high yields, and environmental performance? There are many other venues when Phil Robertson and others talk about greenhouse gas mitigation and other services, but I'm going to talk today a lot about yield and yield variability. Since I think, seeing some of the speakers that went before me, that we all took the opportunity to look a bit about resilience, and I interpret that in terms of yield variability, like Michelle Cavagelli's work. So what sort of treatments are we talking about? In this case, this is a management intensity gradient going from conventional tillage to no-till to low input, and or I'll come into more detail on these, and then an organic or biological one based just on legume crops and cover crops, no manure. So basically this corn, soybean, wheat rotation, we do have a no-till, so I'm glad to see we're part of the elite five that was mentioned by Michelle Cavagelli in terms of comparison to organic. We also compare ourselves to a number of perennial vegetation and biomass, now kind of related to biofuels, but I think this was put together with a lot of forethought in terms of having a woody perennial, vegetative perennial, alfalfa, and then a number of unmanaged ecosystems, such as late successional forests. Of course, we couldn't stick hundreds and hundreds of year-old forests in the middle of our long-term management systems, but we were able to do some monitoring, as you'll see. So we have both the main site. Let's see if I can... I'm not going to do that after Cindy was moving the arrow around. Okay, so basically you have these hectare-sized plots, and these are randomized. Completely randomized block design, and with six replicate blocks. We have successional systems, as I said, in the landscape, where we are monitoring three sites per each of the different forest types. And then we have a number of manipulative areas on the north side of each hectare plot, which I'm going to talk about in a little more detail. So the main site experiments in terms of field crops include both a conventional and a no-till corn soybean wheat. Originally, it was just a corn soybean, and as we've heard earlier today, corn is becoming popular, and we do have some satellite trials that look at biodiversity in terms of continuous corn versus rotational. But in the main site, we try to beat a pretty good system, or try, can we use biology to match what is a good conventional practice with wheat still in there, which is not always true. We also, in the low input system, in the biology or organic system, we included two cover crops. It's changed a little over time, but now we use cereal rye, as we heard from Wisconsin, Aaron Silva and others, that basically, you know, cereal rye can be planted as late as November and still give us good cover after corn. We have soybean, and then we grow wheat, so that acts as the winter cover that year. And then in March or April, we establish an understory of red clover. So we're getting two cover crops in there, one of them fixing nitrogen, and we also hear a little bit about phosphorus. And we also have a soybean providing some of the nitrogen in the system. This is important because, as you'll see, the biological systems may be stressed in terms of nitrogen. And then we have a successional system, which is simply, this had about 100 years of field crops, and then it was just let, it's occasionally burned, but otherwise it's been let go to weeds and so on. Okay, so here is one block, Rep 5, showing the perennial vegetation, alfalfa, perennial poplar, and then the corn, soybean, wheat. One thing you'll note is there's only soybean here. This is for a soybean year, such as in 2012. We only have one phase one year per year. And I'm sure that Professor Harwood, who's in this room and helped during some of the early design, you know, pointed out some of the challenges and aspects of this, because we don't have every crop every year, so we can't see very well how it interacts with weather except over the really long term, which we're trying to move towards. So here's just showing you what the winter cover crops look like. A red clover established, as I said, in March or April, and then the wheat's harvested, and then here's it is providing us biomass that's then turned in before the corn, and then cereal rye in corn stubble. Graduate student looking at a monitoring site and know the fallow system. So here's something that is a very simple slide and yet actually took about 6 years of work. When I joined in 2006 as the agronomist in the LTR co-PIs, we call them, all the researchers that are involved, there was a protocol. So this is how a certain protocol, and so as chair of the agronomy committee, where we get together and give advice to the farm manager, we were asked to make call decisions like, do we change the genetics, the crops, varieties? We heard earlier about the discussion organic versus GMO crops, and that's going to come up again. Well, I can say, well, how do we make these decisions just based on a protocol? Protocols are not living documents. So we have this overarching question about can biology replace chemistry, but what is our system objective? These are systems. They are different. Even if we use the same genetics, they are systems. So through many iterations, we came up with these system objectives, and they are a living document, so keep moving. And keep now they are agreed upon, but I'm sure they'll be revisited in 5 to 10 years, if I have anything to say about it. It's important to know what are your system objectives. In our case, we decided that T1, or system 1, is the conventional, should represent the prevailing norm for tilled field crop farming in the upper Midwest. So let me put a little boundaries around that. No-till, prevailing norm for no-till. Low input, using biology-based management to reduce synthetic chemical input. So back to our original hypotheses. And then biological or organic field crop farming using biologically based management to eliminate synthetic chemical inputs. So this helps guide us. And through this process, we decided to actually change the genetics. So we are now using GMO stacked hybrids for corn and also GMO soybean, because that is the prevailing norm, 80 to 90%, depending who you believe in our area. So we have those For a long time, we tried to come up with varieties that could be grown conventionally but also organically, and we just had to move away from that. And that does have implications because of differences in yield potential. And it's actually getting almost impossible to get isolines without the SAC genes in that. So that was one thing that didn't come out in the earlier discussion, that you actually can't get a seed. You have to go to an organic type of variety. And there hasn't been the investments, as was brought out, in those. So the yield potential may be lower. So let's get to some results. The LTR corn yield, I'll start with, is often the money maker and is really important in terms of farmers' decision making and policymakers' decision makings. So over time, you can see that conventional and no-till stay high, particularly no-till yields have gradually increased over time, and even the low input. I'll give you some statistics in a minute, but I just want to show you the trends over time. Organic, on the other hand, has been consistently lower, as others people have found. And also remember, this has no manure added, so it's actually quite amazing at about 1% carbon, organic carbon soils, to me, that we are getting these high of corn yields. Without manure, just with based on 1 year out of three red clover and then 1 year of soybean for our nitrogen inputs, because it's a very much a nitrogen and water-driven system, as you'll see in a minute. So soybean, on the other hand, has been quite high. All the treatments, including organic, have maintained yields. Every year there's a soybean yield, including 2012. We'll look at that one in a little more detail in a minute. That's a drought year, as we heard. And no-till also seems to be coming up there. So conventional and organics are identical in soybean. Makes you think nitrogen, doesn't it? Okay, LTR wheat yields, on the other hand, again, much lower in the organic, and even in the low input, possibly because low input and organic both have a competition of red clover. Although we know much of the literature says that red clover doesn't really reduce wheat yields. It's also possible with the latest hybrids of wheat and higher population densities that conventional is moving towards, we actually are seeing problems with trying to put an intercrop into that system compared to older types of varieties. So relative yields, so these are all the yields of each of the crops over these 25 years almost now of the experiment. And corn, so 100% with the line is, that's conventional. And you can see no-till, significantly higher. And this is a permanent no-till, I want to mention, because in fact in our area most farmers do no-till soybean, but the majority then till before corn for lots of reasons. And there are a few farmers, like us, that just always stick with no-till. So perhaps certain soil types, philosophy, conditions support this, and maybe it may take many years, but we're really starting to see some returns to that permanent no-till. But it is a certain type of no-till, so I just want to mention that. Reduced input system is also doing very well over time, and is growing, coming up. The biologically based, as I said, soybean is the same as conventional, so that's great. You can get the same soybean yields. However, as other people have seen, we see a yield penalty in corn and in wheat. So this drought year gave us an opportunity to look at this resilience issue. And so in terms of yields, no-till really is outstanding in terms that soybean yields are much higher in no-till. So why is that? Why is it doing so much better? Maybe, as we heard from our previous speaker, has something to do with soil water holding capacity. So in this experiment, we do 3 to 4 weeks every monitoring throughout the season, the growing season, as long as we can get out there. And this data is actually on the web. It is accessible. That, and we also look at inorganic nitrogen. We look at total carbon nitrogen. We look at yields. This data and many other long-term data sets related to this is available to you, to your students, to postdocs who are ambitious. So we really encourage you to go to the LTR website at the Kellogg Biological Station and, you know, with, you know, of course, attention to, we have to do a little data checking for quality, but then we get it up there in the web. And it is for use in meta-analysis and other types of analysis. So please do feel free to use it. So a student, an undergraduate, looked at the data from 2012. This is just gravimetric soil moisture. So we just take samples, dry them, see how much water was in them at different points in time. And you can see we calculated around 20% more water was being held in the no-till. The moisture over time was higher. So clearly this could have contributed greatly to that increase in yield in soybeans. So we are seeing the soil carbon, which I will get to, their impacts on soil function. So that's exciting. So let's look at a little bit of coefficient of variation, because after all, that's a lot of one aspect, important aspect of resilience, is how do these vary at different points in time. So this is spatial variation. In a minute I'll talk about temporal variation. So this is spatial variation. In 1993, this was the coefficient of variation, for example, not very different, different treatments. A little bit high for organic, as we see a trend. Conventional, often, particularly in corn, where the yields can be very high, but also the variability is quite high. Low input and no-till stand out for their low variation, 15 and down to almost 5%, which you'll see is similar to wheat. It's quite striking. Soybean, on the other hand, is a little bit lower overall, and only no-till has a significantly less coefficient of variation, so around 5%. So that's quite modest coefficient of variation. Wheat, even lower. So this isn't too surprising. Wheat is a highly buffered crop, and it's grown over quite a long time period, able to collect moisture at different times. It's also, same with nitrogen mineralization, it can take advantage of that over a longer time period. It doesn't have the sensitive pollination issues that corn does. So it's not too surprising to be so much lower, but it's something to think about as we move into a more variable climate in Michigan. We know that almost all the models predict, and we're already seeing, these really intense flooding events, intense dry spells. So we have much more erratic rainfall, same total amount, possibly more, but clearly having to deal with more erratic rainfall, which maybe wheat is more suited to deal with. And there's really no evidence to support this idea that organic, in some circumstances, could reduce the variation. In fact, the opposite. So what's the temporal variability over, I just picked from 93, when we had all three crops in the rotation until 2002. And we see, again, corn. We see very similar trends. Corn in conventional and organic is quite high, whereas wheat quite low, particularly in the no-till. So we're seeing similar inter and intra variability in terms of these different crops and their interactions with management. So this is kind of the bottom line. Surprisingly, the low input system is performing pretty well. So somehow if you have biology, the cover crop, cover crops, providing their weed management inputs, their nitrogen inputs, soil conserving inputs, as you'll see in a minute, and possibly judicious amounts of fertilizer. And I should have mentioned it's only, originally it was about 40%. Now we're almost down to about 30% of the total amount of nitrogen that's in conventional is put into that low input. So two-thirds reduction in terms of fossil fuels. We currently, the weed management with Roundup Ready genetics is actually the same across the systems. Originally, it was a banded herbicide and reduced in that way. So we are seeing some very large reductions in fertilizer and much more less variable yields. So what's making this possible? Let's look a little bit at soil fertility and organic matter over time. So we monitor soil carbon and nitrogen. Phosphorus pools have only been monitored through students' experiments, and the north end of each plot is which we save for students' experiments. And we have small manipulative plots there. So here's Courtney Gallagher standing up taking a soil probe sample. There's one of my students who, this paper is just coming out now, where she looked at biology and management system effects on phosphorus in renewable ag and food systems. So really pleased to see that coming out. And this work was supported, and it was able to, we could do this student project because of the soil archives. Now, we really don't have Rothamsted soil. I wish I did. But I took a picture of that because from the web, but because I think this is actually one of the world's treasures, right, that we have these 150-year-old soil samples that we can understand soil processes and even the air that was trapped in those bottles. And so I really encourage everyone keeping your soil archives organized. I know I didn't take a picture of mine, by the way. But the LTR has a new system set up. It's really beautiful. We do keep these up to date, and there's really opportunities there to see changes over time. So she analyzed archive soils from 1992, 2001, and 2006, measuring total carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, but also labile phosphorus, including particulate organic matter, as one measure of organic phosphorus, which we heard earlier, microbial might be an important one. Brae pea as an extractable inorganic pea, and then also what's plant available. Since I'm a plant nutritionist by training, I'm always interested in ultimately how much of that and what sort of forms is available to plants. So one of the exciting findings from this work was that, contrary to much of speculation and a little bit of data, we thought that, organic is maintaining available phosphorus, plant-available phosphorus, the inorganic pool. So much of the literature said that organic should, because you're taking off and taking off and taking off phosphorus, that it should be going down, right? However, we have to take into account the fact that also that only about 20% or so, that's being generous, maybe 15% in many studies, of phosphorus fertilizer we add is actually moves into the available pool. So it's actually a very crude tool to change phosphorus availability. And biology also can improve that so that we can get 25, 30% available over a certain time period. So through organic acids from legumes or through manure additions that add phosphorus, but also organic acids to mobilize phosphorus, we can manipulate inorganic phosphorus, so we have to keep that in mind. And simple budgets that assume we're at some sort of equilibrium sometimes miss some of this. So at least in these soils, which although they're very low in carbon, 1% or so, as I said, they actually have fairly high phosphorus because farmers pass fertilization patterns. So over time, they were certainly driven down, as you can see, because 1992, they have higher levels. And so by 2001 and 2006, there seemed to be stabilizing at other levels. Even though organic was taking off without any additions, in our case, it's still able to be maintained the same levels as conventional and alfalfa. Successional system is only burned, much less removal, so not surprising that we have a fair bit of phosphorus there. So let's look at the organic, or one way to get some insights into the organic pool through particulate organic matter phosphorus, so a light-large fraction of organic matter. Here is where the systems that have more legume residues and more organic residue inputs, maybe, as we've heard other people speculate, the quality of those residues and mixture diversity is helping support much higher levels in the organic and in alfalfa, and especially the successional compared to the conventional. So perhaps these pools are helping support those relatively high yields, particularly in the soybean, because we looked at this relative to soybean availability. So lots more to be done in this area, I think. As I said, the biological and the low input systems both rely very much on red clover. So through natural abundance work, my student Brooke Wilkie has looked at nitrogen fixation inputs, which have varied quite a lot. And this is where we partly come back to good agronomy. Over time, we've learned how to grow much better red clover, and I think that that's really important, just getting enough biomass, getting it on established early. There's also about longevity and good sand density to get good nitrogen fixation. It's a wide range of inputs each year. So bottom line, particularly for resilience, I think is the soil carbon story. So it is really challenging to look at changes in soil carbon over time. I just want to repeat that because there's issues of bulk density, the layers that you end up taking because of changes in bulk density. So in 2000 compared to 1992 and 2001 or so, when we just, the first 10 years, We've been able to see there wasn't huge changes in bulk density yet, and so you can see clearly that no-till is improving carbon pretty fast, at least in the topsoil. And then biological with cover is also increasing it, not quite as fast, but perhaps more stably. Stuart Grandy did some of this work with Phil Robertson, and he found, in fact, that that aggregates that are tilled are quickly disassociated, but if they're tilled in the organic system, we actually have more stable microaggregates. So it is, as everyone says, partly getting quality and large amounts of residues, but it's also about tillage, and also I think there's a certain thing to be said about you actually, in some cases, may be able to do some tillage and stabilize the carbon. Some of that carbon may have to go off to stabilize the rest, but that might be a little bit heretical. And there's work that Grandy and others are doing with Isotopic to follow up on some of this, to try and understand how are we getting more carbon in the organic despite all the tillage. Obviously, the alfalfa and poplar systems and early successional as perennials are also building carbon and perhaps showing us where we could aim for with our different systems. So, my conclusions. Biology can indeed sometimes substitute for chemical inputs. Yields were maintained in soybean, in the biologically grown, but not in the cereals, and there is an opportunity cost there unless you happen to be able to afford or have a dairy so you have manure access to manure in large amounts. And yields were high, but had lower variability in the no-till crop, so it's a real win-win system. With our case, with modest increases in herbicide. And yields were maintained with moderate variability and low input, so that was quite exciting. Although, as the economist on our group always points out, this is the one system that hasn't been adopted by farmers, perhaps because the organic gets a premium, and so it supports an old other type of system. So something to remember. And finally, soil organic matter for all systems were increased over conventional, and they've continued to increase. And the gains were fastest in the no-till system, and soil fertility, including some phosphorus and nitrogen, was surprisingly, compared to what we expected, maintained in the organic system. And there's many people that make this all possible. I've mentioned a few there. Thanks very much.